The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
Let me ask you about one part of the film. When the geese respond to the aerial predator, do you think that's built in? Is that a fixed action pattern? How could you find out? Yes?
You see, similar species react the same way, like when our chickens were protecting their young ones in a similar way.
Yeah, many ground living birds in particular will respond very similar to the way those geese responded. Here's one way it's been investigated. You take geese that are reared by humans like that and expose them to a silhouette that looks like a bird, and you can make the silhouette move. So here, let's illustrate it here. Okay, so you make a shape like that. If you pass such a silhouette over the heads of those birds in this direction, they don't react. If you pass it in this direction, they show the reaction you saw in the film. What's the difference? Well, the short neck is the shape. If the short neck indicates a predator, a hawk, you know, a bird of prey. The long neck indicates a goose or duck-like animal, so they're not dangerous. And the experiments have been done, and the indications are that they have a built-in response. It wouldn't necessarily be, we remember the jackdaws seem to learn about predators. They react to the dangling black thing, but then they learn by the way their parents respond which animals are dangerous. But a number of experiments like that have been done. Let's talk briefly about fixed action patterns. Yawning is a human fixed action pattern. Can we name some other human fixed action patterns? Yes? Yeah, swallowing is a fixed action pattern. But wait a minute. Look at this question. Many ethologists distinguish fixed action patterns from reflexes. You could talk about a swallowing reflex. How about a yawning reflex? Is there a difference between fixed action patterns and reflexes? Lawrence and his students argued that there was a difference, a clear difference. In the literature, there's differing opinions. Some people said that fixed action patterns were simply complex polysynaptic reflexes. Okay. But let me give you some examples and you think about the difference. Give examples of a reflex. How about the withdrawal reflex? If I'm running my finger along the table like this and it suddenly hits something very sharp, I'll pull back without any thought. In fact, I'll pull back before I think about it. Is that a reflex or a fixed action pattern? We call it a reflex, withdrawal reflex. Similarly, if I step on something hot, I'll just hold my foot up. And automatically my other leg will stiffen to support myself. Again, that'll happen, and I'll think about it later, the next instant. But I will react before I think. So we call those reflexes. The author of your text, Scott, uses the term reflex really just to mean automatic. He doesn't seem sensitive to the difference that Lawrence and his students talked about. But let me name a few, with your help, some other human fixed action patterns. Sneezing, okay? That's true. You could call sneezing a fixed action pattern. But it's also been called a reflex in response to stimulation. You know, and we know there are stimuli that cause sneezing. One to me that's very clear, but that is usually called a reflex, is the eye blink. Why do I call it a fixed action pattern? Think about it. Some of you have had my 901 class might remember this. How many have had 901 from me? Brigitte, several of you. Okay. I don't know if you remember this. Okay. Smiling, fixed action pattern. Other emotional expressions. We have some general action patterns that are used in many different processes, many different drives, like locomotion. That could be called a fixed action pattern. Yes?
Someone that I've been wondering about, if you have like 5 minutes left in class and you hear one person start to put up their stuff, rustling around papers and moving their bag, and it seems like everyone else immediately starts putting up their stuff.
That's called social facilitation. And we certainly have that built into us. We tend to do things that other people are doing, and there's many examples of that. You're right. Let's talk about this. We've named a number, and we could go on and on and on. Humans probably have more fixed action patterns than many animals. I mean, we are complex creatures. We're born with all kinds of built-in things that, however, we also have a lot more learning. There's a huge overlay of learning, the way these fixed action patterns are integrated in our daily behavior. Lawrence would say, and I would agree, that a fixed action pattern has a motivational component that's distinguishable from the actual action pattern. Okay. So let's take the example. Let's start with something really simple, like the eye blink. Why do I call it a fixed action pattern? Because if I don't blink my eye for a long period of time, the probability that I will blink my eye increases steadily with no change in stimuli. We know this from staring contests. You stare at your friend and see who blinks first. Well, what happens? The probability of someone blinking increases and increases over time. And it becomes a struggle to inhibit your blink. Some people can do it much more readily than others. Okay, so that we can call that a drive aspect. The drive increases. Lawrence called that, he assumed that there's something going on in the nervous system. He called it an action-specific potential. Okay. Western psychologists studying motivation have called, for example, Peter Milner, have referred to a central motive state, emphasizing that it's something that's building up within the CNS. Or some people just call it a drive. Drive often has other implications too. That's why Lawrence came up with the idea of action-specific potential. So in general, the action-specific potential builds up over time the longer the action does not occur, the more that builds up. And when it reaches a certain point, the action is triggered. You say, but wait a minute, a lot of these things are dependent on a stimulus. Lawrence's idea is that what the stimulus does is it increases the action-specific potential, sometimes at a very great rate. In fact, some fixed action patterns don't build up very much without the stimuli. For example, escape behavior. The tendency to display escape behavior does build up over time. An animal that's just displayed it, okay? It depends on what it is and the situation. If you trigger it, a certain kind of escape behavior in a hamster, say from an overhead predator, you know, you'll be very likely to get it again, very short in the period. But if he's in a safe place, you'll be less likely to get it. Okay. This has been difficult to study in the laboratory because of the way it disappears so rapidly. Okay, so it builds up over time. It's in certain stimuli cause the action-specific potential to build up rapidly and then it is executed. Now, you would predict from that model that many of these fixed action patterns then should appear even without stimuli or with very slight stimuli. Well, that's what happens with the eye blink. You know, we blink periodically because that some potential, some central motive state builds up and builds up, and then it takes very little stimulus. The stimulus, slight air currents or even from our eyelids, are enough to trigger it. And then we show the eye blink. Swallowing is similar. That seems strange because we know there's a stimulus in the back of the throat that will trigger not just a gag reflex, it will trigger swallowing. And that's true, but if you interpret it as a fixed action pattern, you can explain more about that behavior because we do swallow with almost no stimulus, no apparent stimulus at all. We swallow periodically. That has a good function, keeps our throat good. Okay. But what about a reflex? What about that withdrawal reflex? You know, we don't want it to change very much. We want it to function all the time, unless we're dead, you know, or unless we're totally exhausted. And that's generally true. Real reflexes are there all the time. They are subject to adaptation if they're triggered repeatedly. And, of course, the animal can become exhausted and not show them. But except for those things, it's always there. So, some of Lawrence's students, one of them coined the term the mantle of reflexes. A mantle is a coat that you wear. It's always there. You're wearing it all the time. And it's on the background of that mantle of reflexes that the fixed action patterns occur. And you can, in a model of behavior, if you're simulating it, without any learning whatsoever, if you have fixed action patterns and reflexes, you can have a behaving animal. Okay? Yeah?
With reflexes, do they involve the brain or just the spinal cord?
Brain or spinal cord. Can be either one. Many reflexes are local. Segmental reflexes, we call them. The stretch reflex is a segmental reflex. A withdrawal reflex can be segmental. It can also be intersegmental. If it's a strong stimulus, it will affect other segments. Because a very strong stimulus to my foot will cause not just the toe that touched the stimulus to withdraw, but the ankle will flex, the leg will bend, and so forth. If it's very strong, my knees might buckle. Okay. But there are many reflexes involving brain that the inputs come in through the cranial nerves. Okay? Yes?
In the video, it says that Lawrence tried to look at what are some behaviors the animals, the human also obtains that kind of behavior, such as how the geese try to protect the young when something is thrown by Lawrence, wondering whether the humans obtain that behavior from the animals. the same thing happens with fixed action patterns or reflexes.
The reflexes are generally almost all the social behaviors, not reflexes. It's fixed action patterns, you know. But it doesn't mean there's no stimulus triggering. And that's where this, I told you that sometimes the definition gets difficult. It's this point, the action-specific potential, that distinguishes the fixed action pattern best, I think, from a reflex. The reflex is always there, doesn't build up over time, you know, might show some habituation. But these are things shown by fixed action patterns too, and the stimuli that trigger them. So let's talk more about fixed action patterns. I want you to understand, first of all, we talk about key stimuli that will trigger the fixed action pattern. A stimulus can also be supernormal. What does that mean? Something that's better at triggering the fixed action pattern than the normal stimulus. So I want you to know examples of that. The one in Scott, he gives an example of a releaser of a fixed action pattern here in gold chicks. A stimulus he found, or other people that Tinbergen and students found, that was better than the mother gull's or the parent gull's beak with a red spot on it. Do you remember that? Yes. Yeah, a pencil, yellow pencil with red bands on it, will actually trigger the mouth opening and so forth, the feeding response of the chick, even more than the mother gull's appearance. Can you think of other examples of supernormal stimuli in animals? Another one studied by that was particularly dramatic, and the term supernormal stimulus was particularly appropriate, was the egg rolling behavior of the gull, the herring gull living on beach. If an egg rolls out of her nest, she has this response to it. She reaches out with her long neck, pulls the egg back. Okay. Well, if the egg is bigger than normal, it triggers that response better. And if there's two eggs, the biggest one will be the one she pulls back. So if you put a goose egg in with the gull eggs, she'll go after that one. It's obviously it's a supernormal stimulus. It just means the specificity of the inputs is limited. Sometimes it's very, very simple. Any oval, round, oval egg shape is enough to trigger that behavior, and the bigger it is, the stronger the response will be. Generally, it will have a limit, of course. But those are examples of supernormal stimulus. So think about supernormal stimulus that affect human behavior, because there are many, you know, and people can behave very foolishly sometimes because of supernormal stimuli. Okay. Okay. Now this isn't 901, but you do have to know a little bit about the nervous system. You're understanding the key stimuli that trigger a fixed action pattern. You have to know something about sensory processes, how that's processed by the nervous system. I want you to know at least some very basic definitions of the nervous system that you should remember from 901 if you've had it. Let's just define these. I don't want you to depend for nervous system things on Scott. He's not particularly good at that. Okay? So I'll just point that out rather than going through the chapter pointing out every little detail where I think he's in mistake. I want you to pay attention to other things you've learned. What is a primary sensory neuron? How does it differ from other sensory neurons? Does it differ from a receptor? Well, a receptor doesn't have to be a neuron, okay? Some receptors are parts of neurons. But what's the difference between, say, the primary sensory neuron and an interneuron? The primary sensory neuron cell body is outside the central nervous system. Okay, so it's not part of the, it's not in the brain or the spinal cord. So, for example, the primary sensory neuron that my finger is responding to here when I touch the table, where's that primary sensory neuron? It's in a ganglion near the spinal cord that has this long extension, an axon, that comes out near the skin where the neuron is different. It forms a little dendritic area that's responsive to inputs. Okay? So that's the definition. Is it's a sensory neuron outside the CNS. We call it the primary sensory neuron. It's part of the peripheral nervous system, the PNS. Okay. Secondary sensory neuron is the neuron that gets the input from the primary sensory neuron. And the secondary sensory neuron is inside the central nervous system, inside the CNS. Okay. So if here's our CNS, and here's the neuron ending in the skin, here's its cell body, and here it enters the CNS. Okay? There's the primary sensory neuron. In here, the neurons that are contacted by this neuron are the secondary sensory neurons if they receive a contact inputs from that primary sensory neuron. Okay. And every neuron, and now what about motor neuron? Can someone define motor neuron for me? You remember? Yes.
They're connected to muscles to control movement.
Okay, they're connected to muscles or some other effector, might be a gland. Okay. Where's the cell body?
Outside.
No. In the CNS. If it's a somatic motor neuron, you're right, for autonomic nervous system, they're in ganglia outside the CNS. But the somatic motor neuron, we'll draw one of them here, and we'll draw a few of them. They have axons going out, and their contacts are on muscle, okay? So here's the muscle, say a striated muscle, okay? Yes, this is CNS. You can see the axon here is leaving the CNS. If this is spinal cord, the secondary sensory neurons are in the dorsal part, and these axons are coming in the spinal nerves. Okay, so-called dorsal roots coming in. But the motor neuron is in the ventral part of the spinal cord, and the axon goes out and contacts somatic muscles. Okay. I won't try to teach you all of anatomy. You can take my class on that. But I want you to know some basic definitions. That leaves interneurons, which are all the rest. Okay? The connections are not usually so direct here, except in the case of a simple reflex between the primary sensory neuron and the motor neuron. In the case of that withdrawal reflex, it could be as simple as this. Okay, so here, here's the primary sensory neuron. It's synapsing on a secondary sensory neuron, okay, which is the interneuron here, which then synapses on a flexor, a motor neuron that innervates the flexor muscles and causes the leg to withdraw. Okay, so that would be the simplest circuit involving one interneuron. Most processes involve many interneurons. And the interneurons can be connected in various complex ways to organize our behavioral patterns. Okay? So a few simple definitions. I want to know a little more about the nervous system here. Tell me, tell me what the specializations of nerve cells. How are the nerve cells different from other cells in your body that makes all this behavior possible? First of all, they're irritable, meaning they will respond to inputs. They're irritable. They respond to stimulation of some sort. They conduct. They conduct a change. They respond, first of all, to a change. How do they respond? How does a primary sensory neuron respond when it gets input? What happens? Its membrane depolarizes. Okay? Its membrane depolarizes. And the neuron, though, has specialized for conduction. First of all, the depolarization spreads in the cell. It spreads along the membrane. Okay? But the real specialization is, there are other cells that do that. A leaf can show depolarization to touch. But what the leaf doesn't do is can't conduct long distances. I mean, this neuron in my finger, that responds in my finger here, the effect is conducted rapidly past that cell body right into the central nervous system. How does it do that? By means of an action potential that's triggered at one point, okay, near where the stimulus was. It's called the axon hillock, okay? And we're talking about the action potential. If you don't know these terms, you've not had these classes, please look them up. Give yourself a little more information about neurons. If you've forgotten about them, you know, review it a little bit. I promise you we won't focus on central nervous system organization in this class, because I teach another class for that. We will focus on behavior. But to understand some things about behavior, including some things about fixed action patterns, you have to know a little bit about this. And the last part is transmission. It has the ability to transmit that effect that's being conducted down the axon to other neurons. Normally at synapses. Synaptic contacts on other neurons, where the effect, usually by a means of a chemical transmitter, it goes from one cell to the other. That's how the influence of one cell is transmitted to another. Okay? But these are the properties that are essential: irritability, conduction, and transmission. Okay? Let's get back to behavior now. I should mention that one other property here that is particularly relevant to understanding behavior is the way that action potential is triggered at the axon hillock. Let's take, say, a motor neuron that causes a withdrawal reflex. If it just gets input from one interneuron, might not be enough to trigger an action potential in that motor neuron. So my muscle won't respond. If there's no action potential in the motor neuron, there'll be no behavior. Okay? Even though the input's there, okay? So what happens? Why do you get so much behavior? Because of summation effects, okay? If the same motor neuron is getting inputs from multiple axons, different parts of the neuron surface, they will summate at the axon hillock of that motor neuron. You also get temporal summation. So if things happen rapidly enough, they build up in time. Because the input, when it reaches a cell, takes a little time to decay, so it lasts a little while. And so if other inputs arrive quickly enough, that they will summate. So you get spatial and temporal summation, and that's what normally leads to action potentials. Okay. So similarly in behavior, a single stimulus might not be enough to elicit, say, a fixed action pattern, But a stronger stimulus might, and different key stimuli can sum together to produce, to will result then in a fixed action pattern. There's many examples of that in behavioral studies. And it's just because of the properties of neurons. Already run out of time, and where are we? Okay, well, we'll go back to this next time, and then I'll have another reading and things posted for you on the web.